Thank you all very much. I find one of the first, I just arrived a few hours ago, and one of the most encouraging things about trying to find a place to park is how there are almost no high-status cars parked anywhere. It shows a lot of you know that's not what life is about, and it's really encouraging. In fact, I'm going to tell you what you all already know. That inequality is divisive and socially corrosive. And that's not just a private intuition you might have. It's something that you can see in the data. I'm going to show you lots of graphs, which might sound a bit boring. And I know the people at the back won't really be able to see them. So more than boring. But I'm a little bit encouraged because after one of our talks, an old Quaker lady said, I didn't know I could have so much fun spending an evening looking at graphs. emboldened by that, I'm going to start. I'm going to show you that most of the problems in our society that are worse at the bottom of the social ladder, you know, whether you look at health or drugs or violence or teenage births, are much worse in more unequal societies. Societies with bigger income differences between rich and poor. And that has huge implications for how we understand those problems. And I think many people look at social gradients, think that the vulnerable end up at the top, at the bottom, and the resilient end up at the top, and that's why we have social gradients. But that's just sorting the population. If I was to sort you people by hair color, put the blonde ones and maybe the gray-haired ones at that side and the dark-haired ones at that side, that wouldn't make any hair color more common in our society. So it's not, these social gradients are not simply a matter of sorting. The fact that they get worse as income differences get worse means they are substantially a product of social differentiation itself, of social class differences, of hierarchy, of social distances between rich and poor, and the things that does to us all. When I talk about that, I'm talking more, if you like, about a sense of superiority and inferiority. I'm talking about the psychological effects of material differences. But don't think, because I'm talking about the psychological effects, that you can forget about the material differences and just make people feel better despite them. You have to do something about the reality itself. You can do a tiny bit by trying to make people feel better about their awful reality, but the main thing is to change that reality. I like to show this slide. It's outside Oxford Street tube station. It shows what a miserable lot we are. And presumably the few people there, there are about three using mobile phones, even they're probably talking to their friends, and yet even they look miserable. There's not a face that isn't miserable. And if you think that in our societies, we're living with unprecedented comfort and wealth. If we'd known, if people had looked forward to this in the 19th century, we'd have thought we'd be living in some kind of social utopia, with extraordinary levels of human harmony and so on. Instead of finding, you know, so many social problems are getting worse rather than better. Where I want to start is, in a way, by getting economic growth and absolute living standards out of the picture. This graph, which you probably can't see unless you're in the front few rows, shows life expectancy up the side in relation to national income per person. Along the bottom. And on the, I'm trying to think whether it's the same way round for you as for me, on the left, you have the poorer developing countries. And what you see is very rapid rises in life expectancy in the early stages of economic growth. And then it levels out. We still have big improvements in life expectancy, but no longer related to economic growth. And what's really interesting is if instead of looking at life expectancy in relation to national income per capita, you look at happiness or measures of well-being, you find just the same relationship. Rapid rises early on in economic growth, and then it tails off. And the importance of that, I think, is, of course, in poorer countries where many people haven't got basic necessities, it's important to raise material standards. But for us in the rich world, having more and more of everything ceases to make much difference. You know, economic growth is what's transformed human life, but it's largely done its work in the rich countries. And I think that's really important to remember when you know, all these interminable discussions about whether we have to sacrifice economic growth for sustainability, as if we were sacrificing something so crucially important to our well-being. It's no longer crucially important. I'm going to talk just about those countries on the top right of that graph. I'm going to blow that little bit up so you can see it a little bit better. Probably even at the back you can't read that. Tell me how far back people can read the names of these countries. If you can read them, put your hands up. So if you're sitting in the floor, you can, but if you're on the... Okay, I'll read them to you. On the right, you've got USA and Norway. At the top, Japan. On the far left, you've got Israel, Greece, Portugal, and a great bunch in the middle, Spain, New Zealand, Singapore, Sweden, Australia, France, Italy, Germany, Finland, Denmark, Ireland, UK, Netherlands, Austria, Belgium, Switzerland, Canada. I'm going to be using those countries to show you the effects of inequality. So just the rich developed countries where economic growth no longer makes a difference. And the countries on the right, Norway and USA, are twice as rich as Israel, Greece and Portugal, and it makes no difference to their life expectancy at all. And yet everyone here, I suspect, knows that health is worst in the most deprived areas of our societies. Always in the poorest areas, health is worst. Life expectancy is substantially lower. You know, it's I think, the biggest human rights abuse in our societies. The huge difference in health and death rates between better off and less well off. But there's a paradox. You know, look at these countries, and if everyone in a society gets richer, it doesn't make any difference. But within our societies, as I say, there is this extraordinary gradient in health going right across. This is data for small neighborhoods in England and Wales. The poorest with the shortest life expectancy are on the right, and the richest with the highest life expectancy on the left. This goes right across our society. When you think about health inequalities, it's no good just thinking about the small, tiny proportion of the population who are homeless or who run out of food for benefit before the next benefit check comes in. You've also got to explain why the people just below the richest have less good health than the richest. People who've probably got two cars and a university education and a good job, they're still less healthy than the people above them. Everyone here is part of this picture of health inequalities. And you must think about that in order to explain it. All that I'm talking about, although it's problems that are more common at the bottom of the social ladder, that actually this picture affects all of us. I'm going to show you that... I'll come back to that. So there's a paradox. Income means something very important within our societies and not between them. The explanation for that paradox is that within our societies we're looking at relative income, social position, social status, where we are in relation to each other and the differences between us. That's what now matters. I'm going to talk a lot about equality and inequality. But I'm never talking about any utopian society that doesn't exist, any perfectly equal society. I'm simply talking about the different amounts of inequality in terms of income distribution in those rich developed market democracies. On the left there, I'm sorry, the measure of inequality we've taken is how much richer are the top 20% than the bottom 20%. It's very easy to understand. How big is that gap between the top and bottom 20%? And the countries on the left, Japan, Finland, Norway, Sweden, the top 20% is 3.5 or 4 times as rich as the bottom 20%. That's the size of the gap. But on the right, in the UK, Portugal, USA, Singapore, the gap is twice as big. We are twice as unequal. And I think when you are looking at this graph, as soon as you realize it's about relative differences, about where we are in relation to each other, you should think, what happens if we stretch out those differences or squash them up? What does it do to the society? And that's really what I'm going to be talking about. So Japan, Finland, Norway, the difference is more squashed up, and then on the right, more stretched out. What we did, you know, this is statistical work. It's pretty simple to understand, so don't feel nervous about statistics. I hate statistics, but I've always had to do them. But I think they do bear out the intuitions people have had for hundreds of years about inequality being divisive and socially corrosive. We collected internationally comparable data on different countries, on life expectancy in each country, on kids' maths and literacy scores, on infant mortality rates, on homicide rates, on imprisonment. That's the proportion of the population locked up, which in Britain now has peaked again after the riots. Teenage births, how much people feel they can trust each other, obesity, mental illness, which in the standard psychiatric classification includes drug and alcohol addiction, and social mobility. Those aren't figures that we decided were comparable or we put together. We got them all from international sources. They had decided whether they were comparable. So the World Bank, WHO, OECD, organizations like that. So all we've done is download their data. So we haven't been choosing what we count and what we don't. We put it all together in one index, sort of rag bag, regard it as a fruit salad of all those health and social problems. Where a country is, is it sort of average performance on all those things? And there it is related to the measure of inequality I've just shown you. At the top end, top right, USA, Portugal, UK, the most unequal countries with the highest levels of all those health and social problems. At the bottom end, Norway, Sweden, Japan, the more equal countries with less of all that. And all the others panned out in between. And it looks like something out of physics rather than social sciences. A little bit of measurement error or something like that. But look, if you look at exactly the same measure of social problems up the side, but look at it in relation to gross national product or economic growth, if you like, there's no relationship. We were worried that people would think that somehow we'd manufactured this relationship, and certainly people on the far right tried to argue that we did manufacture it in some strange way. And, you know, you can't get away as an academic epidemiologist doing that kind of thing. But anyway, we decided also to look at the UNICEF Index of Child Wellbeing. Unlike this, where we chose these components, and you might regard this mainly as adult well-being, the UNICEF Index of Child Well-being is put together by other people to measure well-being amongst children in the rich countries. It contains almost every component of child well-being they could get hold of. So whether children can talk to their parents, what immunization rates are like, whether there's bullying at school, what their maths and literacy scores are like, all that kind of thing, whether they have books at home, all that goes into it. Here it is in relation to inequality. A really clear tendency for the more unequal countries to have lower standards of child well-being. We hear a lot about child poverty as the problem. But it is really important to distinguish between relative poverty and absolute poverty. Look, if we look at that same measure of child well-being in relation to how rich on average each country is, its position in relation to, again, to gross national income. The richest countries do no better than the poorest countries. Child well-being is no longer affected by the average standard of living in these rich developed countries. What matters is how far behind the rest of us children are, how unequal the society they're growing up in is. And of course the implications are quite different. If it was absolute material living standards which was doing the damage, we would need economic growth. But actually, you've got to reduce the gaps between us if you're going to improve child well-being. I'm going to show you some of the separate components of our index. This one's trust. It comes from the World Value Survey. It's simply the proportion of the population agreeing most people can be trusted. And if I asked you, do you feel most people at Greenbelt can be trusted? Probably a large proportion of you put up there. What proportion would, and it's a very vague question, but how many people would put up their arms if they feel most people in society can be trusted? Okay, well, in the UK as a whole, about just under 30% of the population think that most people can be trusted. But look, at the bottom end, at the right, the more unequal countries, it's about 15 or 20% of the population who feel they can trust others. In the more equal countries, it rises to 60 or 65%. Huge differences in that sense of trust. And if I showed you measures of involvement in community life, the strength of community life, exactly the same picture. Inequality is socially damaging in terms of the quality of social relations in our society. And, I think this makes a difference to endless aspects of what our society feels like. You know, if you've got to walk home late at night through a big city, you'd feel much safer doing it in one of the more equal countries. But I think the other aspects of the sort of social functioning matters too. I may say we did all this work twice. We looked at all these relationships that I'm going to show you amongst the rich developed countries, and then we repeated it on a separate test bed. We took the 50 American states, and we asked just the same question. Do the more unequal American states do worse on all these kind of measures? The picture is very substantially the same. What is related significantly, using statistical measures of significance, i.e. can't just be a chance outcome, you find the things related to inequality significantly internationally are also related to inequality amongst the American states. Here, for instance, is that same measure of trust, this time from the American government's General Social Survey, in relation to inequality amongst the states, lower levels of trust in the more unequal states. This is mental illness. It's the proportion of the population who had any mental illness in the preceding year. How they ascertained mental illness was not simply by seeing how many people go to their GP for antidepressants or something, because that will be affected too much by the kind of system of medical care, whether you have to pay for prescriptions and so on. So WHO put together figures simply to allow us to make good comparisons of levels of mental illness in each country. What they did was they used standard diagnostic interviews on random samples of the population in each country. And they found that in the most equal countries, at the bottom end, it's about 8% of the population who had some kind of mental illness. I mean, presumably it's anxiety problems and stress and depression in the more equal countries. But in the UK, you've got about, I think it's 23%. In the USA, 26%. Closely related to inequality. People sometimes ask me about outliers. I usually don't know why they're outliers, so I don't know why Italy does better than we would expect. Here is a measure of infant mortality from WHO. Infant mortality rates substantially higher in more unequal countries. You might look at this. I mean, these lines, the red line drawn through, is the line of best fit. It's what we call the regression line. The computer calculates it on statistical formulae. It's meant to minimize the difference between all the points and the line. And you might think that it's not really going through the main scatter of points. That's because it's being pulled down by Singapore. Do you see Singapore at the bottom right? The most unequal country with reporting the lowest level of infant mortality. I point this out to you because I never believed that figure for Singapore, and yet it's what they report to WHO, and so it goes into our data. The far right have accused us of picking and choosing data, as if we'd manufactured these relationships by leaving out observations that didn't fit. We have never done that. We have an absolute rule that if data for one of the countries we're looking at is available from the source we're using, it goes in. I've since discovered why Singapore has lower infant mortality rates. It's basically that 25% of their population are migrant workers. They're almost wholly the poorest 25%. They're not allowed to have babies, and they're not allowed to get married. They have a health check every year. And if they're married or have a baby, are pregnant, they have to leave. So you remove the section of the population where you'd expect infant mortality to be highest, entirely removed from the picture. Where there are, as in that graph I showed you of mental illness, where not all the countries are there, that's not because we didn't like the observations. It's because WHO hasn't yet made those measures in all the countries. This is violence. It's a very well-established violence, very well-established relationship that inequality and violence tends to be higher in more unequal countries. These red dots are American states. Down at the bottom, they've added in the Canadian provinces. This isn't our work, but there are about 50 papers, research papers in the academic journals, showing that violence tends to be consistently higher in more unequal countries. But look at the scale of the differences. At the bottom left, you've got, well, some of them are below 15 homicides per million population each year. And at the top, there are a few over 150. 10 times as much murder in those societies, closely related to the amount of inequality. And as I say, that's not just our evidence, it's lots of peoples all around the world have shown this. This is imprisonment. I don't expect you ever heard in all the discussions about our prison populations, our prisons overflowing, anyone talk about inequality as a reason. But actually, if you know the UK's level of inequality, you can pretty well read off the level of the proportion of the population you'd expect in prison. So this is the number of prisoners per 100,000 population. And actually, there's about a tenfold difference there. I'm not going to spend time explaining the log scale up the side, but it tends to compress the top of the picture. Most of that relationship, that tendency for more unequal countries to lock more people up, is not about more crime. Most of it is about more punitive sentencing. And actually, the treatment of the kids rioting is an illustration of that. You know, particularly if you compare them with the MPs' expenses scandal and the bankers and so on. And what they have in common is that they all took what they thought they could get away with. What they have that's so different is their social status and their existing wealth. Anyway. As an example, when we were writing our book, we found in California there were over 300 people with life imprisonment for shoplifting because they have a three strikes and you're out law. Absolutely barbaric. And I think some of the sentences, well, the people in prison for not having a television license. Teenage birth rates much higher in more equal countries, more unequal countries, about 5 per 1,000 teenage women at the most equal end. In the UK, we have 6 times that level. In the USA, they have 10 times that level. This is social mobility. Not very many observations here. I mean, not many data countries with data. The measure of social mobility is, do rich fathers have rich sons? I'm afraid the person who put this data together, for reasons you can probably understand, concentrated on fathers and sons. And do poor fathers have poor sons? Or isn't father's income very important? And basically what this shows you is in the more unequal societies, father's income is much more important as a determinant of son's incomes than in the more equal countries. And as we like to say, and Kate has been brave enough, my co-author has been brave enough to stay even when talking to American audiences, if you Americans want to live the American dream, you should go to Denmark. And some of them laugh too. That's a really important relationship, because increasingly there's a tendency to say that the big inequalities in income, the huge unfairness, is somehow fair because there's an idea that maybe everyone can get to the right level in society. Now, we know that we're nowhere near equal opportunities for kids. You've only got to look at the present cabinet to know that. But if you like, if you're really concerned with equal opportunity, then the most important thing to do is to reduce the scale of inequality. It seems to be one of the most important determinants of social mobility and the extent to which we have or haven't got equal opportunities. I've emphasized that these problems are all problems that are more common at the bottom of society, whether you're talking about violence, teenage births, mental illness, life expectancy, whatever. But I also said that it's not just the people at the bottom who are affected. I've been pointing out that very often the differences in how a country performs, you know, 10 times as many people in prison, almost 10 times as many teenage births, 10 times rates of homicide, but other things, 3 times as much mental illness, about twice the infant mortality rates, things like that. The differences are so big because all of us are affected by inequality. It changes the whole quality of the social fabric right up our society. But we don't just infer that from the scale of the differences and say, look, this is too big to be explained by something happening just to the poorest 10%. We can also compare how people are doing at each level in society in more and less equal societies. So we can take people with a particular level of education in more and less equal societies, or a particular social occupational class, or a particular level of in the income distribution. And you find that in the more unequal countries, we all do worse. Here's just one example. This is old data. When people first became interested in comparing health inequalities between countries, and Swedes classified a lot of their infant deaths according to the British occupational class classification. Again, anachronistically, it's a classification of infant deaths by father's occupation. So single parents have to go on their own in that group on the left. But then next on the left is the lowest occupational class, which is unskilled manual workers, then semi-skilled, then the skilled manual, then the junior non-manual, then the intermediate non-manual, and at the extreme right, the professional occupations, doctors, lawyers, directors of larger companies, things like that. You can see that Sweden does better. Sweden is the blue bars. They're shorter all the way across. The differences are biggest at the bottom of society, but even if you're in social class one at the top, your infant mortality rates would be lower if you were in Sweden. I think I better save time by not taking you through many examples of that, but we have 5 in our book and a number of others. There are also much more sophisticated. Our book is an attempt to present this data very simply. And people often think that more sophisticated analyses of the data don't exist. We left those out. The journals, lots of them in the academic journals, and they're pretty nasty to read because they don't try and explain things clearly and use odd statistical terms and so on. But that is the general pattern. Inequality benefits us all, and even those near the top would do a little bit better. And by saying it benefits us all, I'm not saying that if you're, a doctor, that you would be richer in a more equal country. I'm saying you would probably live a bit longer. Your kids would do a little better at school in these maths and literacy scores. They'd be a little less likely to be teenage parents or to get involved in drugs. You would be a little less likely to become a victim of violence. In that sense, you'd do better in a more equal society. Let me come back, though, to this picture I showed you early on where we put all this data into one index, our index of health and social problems. I want to make 2 points. One is that those of you who can see, sitting down, have noticed that it's always the USA, Portugal, UK doing badly, or Singapore when we have data. And it's always Norway, Sweden, Finland, Japan that do well. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at life expectancy or prison populations or teenage births or drugs. Broadly the same pattern. And so what we're looking at is a sort of social dysfunction related to inequality. Not just one or two things that go wrong, but most things that go wrong. As I say, it affects the quality of social relations, it increases status competition, feelings of superiority and inferiority, and is socially divisive in extraordinarily damaging ways. And we forget what intensely social beings humans are. I should also say that you shouldn't look at this and think, can I explain this in some other way without reference to inequality? Could it all be a matter of national differences in culture? Because people have shown some of these relationships so many times. There are 200 papers in the academic research literature on the relationship between health and inequality. So for our critics who take off one or two countries and say, ooh, the relationship doesn't look significant anymore, I want to show them a paper that looked at the provinces of China. And even there, the more unequal provinces have worse health. And say, which ones do you want to pick off to get rid of this suggestion that inequality is harmful, that you hate so much? And it's really nonsense. The other point I want to make is that this isn't simply about higher taxes. Countries can become more equal in quite different ways. Some countries, like Sweden, have very large differences in earnings before tax, and they reduce the differences through high taxes and generous social security systems. But other countries, like Japan, start off with smaller differences in earnings. And they have lower taxes and less generous welfare state, and yet they do well. We find the same contrast looking at the American states. Some of the ones that do well do it more through redistribution, others because they start off with smaller differences in earnings. And of course, the reason why our income differences in Britain and in a great many other countries have widened over recent decades is because the rich have been running away from the rest of us with the bonus culture and so on. So what's this about? Some sort of pecking order. I can't remember where that cartoon comes from. Lynn Marie. I think to understand these issues, you really need to think about our evolved sensitivity to social status differentiation and also to friendship, and to cut the explanations short, I think we're dealing with, as I said, more unequal countries, more sense of superiority and inferiority, bigger social distances, more status competition that drives consumerism, and with that more status insecurity. It drives consumerism because, of course, how you express your status, or how so many people who haven't parked their cars in yeah, express their status is by what they consume and their goods and so on. And it's, you know, if you look at kids at school, the importance of having the right labels. And in the riots, you know, it was the status goods. What kids were pinching was what, you know, the shops are full of what separates them from the lives of the celebrities. Which the goods that show their inferiority. I think that with those worries about status, we judge each other more by status. You know, are you somebody that matters, that I have to respect and pay attention to, or are you somebody I can ignore? As they say in the white, in the States, white trash or whatever. And that tendency to judge people by their social status, you know, that's why it hurts. And we thought the bankers were brilliant until the crash. And so many people talk about the poor as if they were stupid and lazy. I want to tell you a deeper story, though, if I can finish it, get it into the last few minutes. The main psychosocial risk factors for health are low social status, friendship, any measure of your social involvement, the quality of your relationships, how many friends you have, is extremely protective of health. A recent analysis reviewing 150 different academic research studies of health and friendship found that if you look at survival over follow-up period, whether or not you have, or how many friends you have, is more important than whether or not you smoke. It's not just a wishy-washy factor. It's extremely important to our well-being. But stress in early life, early childhood, both maternal stress that affects fetal development and all the things in early childhood about poor attachment, domestic conflict, things like that. But you see, what underlies all those things is really the same kind of vulnerability. Whether you're thought less of because you're low social status, disrespected, or whether you're insecure and feel devalued and so on because you've had a difficult early childhood. They're basically about the same sort of insecurity and feeling not valued and anxiety and so on. And friendship fits into that because if you've got friends, you get positive feedback. There are people who like your company. They think you're a nice person. They laugh at your jokes. But if you start feeling that people choose not to invite you to things, don't sit next to you, avoid talking to you, we all have that sense of vulnerability. Maybe I'm, you know, unattractive, socially gauche, they think I'm stupid. All that self-doubt comes crowding in. And that's a characteristic we all have. And basically what the epidemiology is telling us is that those kinds of worries are one of the most important sources of chronic stress in our society. And increasingly we know how that affects the immune system and the cardiovascular system. And there are now studies which show that actually the things which really push up our levels of biological stress hormones, cortisol, for instance, that you can measure in saliva or in blood, are threats that involve social, well, they talk about social evaluative threats, where people can judge social status, where your self-esteem is on the line, where people can judge you negatively. Those are the things that really get to us and push up our levels of stress hormones. But it's also why violence is more common in more unequal societies. It's because, not because the poor start attacking the rich, it's because
the poor feel disrespected, looked down on, and, you know, loss of face, humiliation are the most common causes of triggers to violence. I'm having to hurry over things, but I do just want to get at something that I see as right at the bottom of this. Social status and friendship come together again and again in this picture. As I said, they're both influences on our health. So if I know your social status and I know whether or not you have friends, I can make some fairly vague, poor predictions of how long you might live. They also come together as they move inversely in society. As I showed, trust deteriorates when you have bigger status differences. I showed that violence becomes more common, and I told you social cohesion declines, community life weakens. That's a quite different way they come together. They also come together because we tend to choose our friends from amongst our near equals. So they're like a sort of Jekyll and Hyde pair. You know, friendship good, social status bad. And they come together because they're the two different ways human beings can associate. You know, either social status is about dominance hierarchies, pecking orders. They're about the strong getting the lion's share. You know, I get it first because I'm stronger. Orderings, social status orderings, are orderings based on power, coercion, on privileged access to resources, regardless of others' need. But friendship is exactly the opposite. Friendship involves a recognition of each other's need. And the gift is the symbol of friendship because it's the concrete expression. I give you this because I recognize your need, and we agree not to fight over access to basic necessities. The anthropologist Marshall Sahlin said, gifts make friends and friends make gifts. And you see, for humans, there's always been the potential for awful conflict if we fight over access to everything, because we all have the same needs, we can compete for everything. But we can also be the best source of friendship, support, cooperation, love, learning, whatever it is. And I think that through our evolution, we have become extremely sensitive to social status and friendship, those two opposite ways of coming together. Either we fight over access to resources or we share. And of course, even in the religious symbolism of communion or the way we eat together, it is essential not to fight over access to the basic necessities of life. That is why we eat together. And it's why hunting and gathering societies where we originated were based on food sharing and gift exchange. Although Hobbes said that life without government to keep the peace would be nasty, brutish, and short because of that conflict of each against all, through most of human evolution, our longest period as hunters and gatherers, we avoided that conflict through sharing, through gift exchange, and so on. And so that's the sensitivity that is being picked up in these statistics and why inequality matters so much, why friendship and social status and early childhood make such a difference. I'm just going to show you what's happened to inequality over the last 30 years, from 1979 to 2010, that huge rise under Thatcher, and then little ups and downs. Brown, in all his budgets, redistributed a little bit, but what he did, the little bit of good he did, was entirely lost by the widening differences in earnings with the bonus culture. So I think we can change our society from being like that to being like that. So I'll end there. You've probably had more than enough, but yeah. I think the most important thing is that people should understand this picture. And in a sense, what it's telling us is the way to improve our real quality of life is no longer by higher material standards and status competition and consumerism. What we need to think about now is the quality of social relations. And the exciting thing is that the quality of social relations, we now have a sort of magic handle on it. You know, by reducing the differences between us, we can improve the psychosocial well-being of our society. But as I said, it's not just about higher taxes and so on, though, and I think in the present political climate it's difficult to campaign on things like that, though I think we can campaign on tax avoidance. It's absolutely essential that we do something about the tax havens and the way so many of the rich and large companies completely avoid tax, meaning that the... And read... this is what you can do. Get people to read this Nicholas Shaxson, Treasure Islands, where he talks about the enormous scale of the amount of rich people's money and business transactions that go through these tax havens that mean the burden of taxation falls on the people lower in society, and then you get reactions like the Tea Party movement in the States. And it's really important. But the way we should deal with the large income differences before tax, the way we should address, if you like, the bonus culture, I think that the bonus culture is a reflection of people at the top feeling they don't have to answer to anyone. They can do what they like. We have to make them answerable, whether it's through having employee representatives or trade union representatives on company boards, as happens in most EU countries, or whether it's by all forms of economic democracy, mutuals, friendly societies, cooperatives, employee ownership, things like that. All those kinds of companies have much smaller income differences. We in the Equality Trust are trying to, we hope to set up a website which will not only show the scale of income differences in companies, but will also help people shop from the more egalitarian and more democratic ones.
Okay, we've got ourselves a microphone here, which is going to be handy. So I'm going to ask for this lady to come out and ask a question. Gentleman at the back, if you can, yes, you can make your way around. And I saw that hand there. Yes, and then we'll take those three, and then we'll kind of see if we've got time. If you can keep them short. Okay, no comments, please, just questions.
Have you seen any examples yet where a province or a company or anywhere has tried to reduce the differentials and seen some improvement?
In companies, in the private in the public sector, of course, there have been various pronouncements, both from Cameron and even Boris Johnson, about reducing the ratio to 1 to 20. I think the Greater London Authority talked about a distant prospect, hoping to reduce it further. There are also there have been a number of fairness commissions springing up. There was one in Islington, set up by local authorities to see how they can reduce their income differences. And there are obviously important things they can do, like paying a living wage to people, but also by campaigning for companies to be open about the scale of income differences within them, and doing business with companies that have a better record on that. There's one now in Islington, in Liverpool. I think Nottingham, York has started one with the sponsorship of the Archbishop of York, I'm glad to say. But, you know, the big problem is in the private sector. We've got to take that message out.
After the riots, we sort of heard like two narratives, like one from the right saying that it was down to break down law and order, break down families, that sort of thing. And then on the left, there's the inequality aspect and lack of jobs, lack of opportunities. I just wonder if, for instance, like Frank Fielden talks about how, people who come from very low incomes, around the same sort of income level, if they come from family with two parents, and they're much less likely to get involved in crime, much more likely to do better, etc. I just wonder, do you think we can ever come to a place whenever we can work towards having making Britain, you know, the most equal country in the world, and also the country which respects marriage the most? And is there some way that we can get both of those, because both seem to be very important?
I don't think it's I think family relationships are crucially important, but I don't think that's predominantly an issue of marriage or not marriage. I mean, increasingly the research people talk about family process, by which they mean the quality of interactions and relationships in the family as being important, rather than whether there are one or two parents, you know, to have fighting parents or a lot of conflict in the family is bad, whatever the structure. However, the picture I've been presenting, it's not family relationships or greater equality. The two go together in a very important way. The early sensitivity of children to the kind of relationships and the kind of family life, which psychologists have, you know, they've always told us that early childhood is important. And we now know how that goes actually back into the mother's pregnancy, because stress hormones cross the placental barrier and affect the development of the fetus. And the same sort of processes changing the way a child develops go on in early childhood. Now, the point of that process, that early sensitivity, exists in endless different species. You know, if you want a nice cat or dog, you should get one that's had a good early start in life. If it's been kicked around, you'll get an animal that's a nervous wreck and probably quite aggressive. What the point of that early sensitivity is to prepare us for the kind of world we're going to have to deal with. And with human beings, that is a matter of preparing us for whether we're growing up in a society where we have to watch our backs, fight for what we can get, learn not to trust others because, you know, we fight for everything. Or whether we're growing up in a society where we depend on reciprocity, on cooperation, where empathy is important. And that needs a quite different emotional and cognitive development. And what's going on in early childhood is the parental experience of adversity is being passed to the child, you know, in all sorts of unconscious ways, usually, whether through maternal depression or being too tired to spend time doing things with your kids or being bad-tempered with them. They all mean the child is less socialized early on. And I don't know whether you remember, several years ago, an awful case in the papers about three women who videoed their kids, their toddlers, fighting. They made them fight, 2 and 3 year olds, fighting, punching each other in the face, kicking each other on the ground in tears. And when they wanted to stop, they'd be told to go back and don't be a sissy or a wimp or whatever. And in the court case, apparently the women showed no remorse and said that it was important to toughen the kids up. Now, they were conscious of the process. The world they experienced, you had to be tough. And so you must think about the ways in which a more unequal society, where we do have to fight for what we can get, affects the quality of early childhood. It's not a chance thing that the people at the bottom often have a harder life and are more streetwise and so on. And it has deep psychological effects.
Hi. I work for Church Action on Poverty, and inspired by your book in large part, we're now campaigning about closing the gap between rich and poor. And if people want to sign up to help do something about it, we're in Northern Lights, just over on the stall. But one of our key things we're campaigning on is tax. We've been having some interesting discussions on our stall about the tax havens. And a lot of people just say, well, companies will just move. So I wonder if you could comment a bit about to what extent we can do something as the UK, and to what extent there has to be international action to do something about that.
I'm really not the person to answer that question. When I finished reading this book, I might come up with a better answer, but I couldn't say anything that I thought was well informed. I'm sorry, it's a really important question, but I've spent my life trying to understand health inequalities and things like that. Tax havens are new to me.
It's just the education one, Richard, on the difference inequality makes on education, on children's performance in education.
Are you wanting me to show the slide I know you, Jane, like? Jane is hooked on a particular slide. And when I leave it out, she always wants me. She knows much more about all this stuff because I just look at numbers. She works with the people involved. But what she wants me to show you is this one. This is a study done by people at the World Bank. They asked children in high and low castes to do mazes. So they were given bits of paper with a maze on it and had to find the way into the center. And they tried to do as many as they could in a given time. They did them under two different conditions, one where they didn't know each other's caste, and then in a different condition where they did know each other's caste. And suddenly, when they do know each other's caste, the lower caste kids do much less well. They've done equally well when they did know each other's caste. And actually, there are just endless experiments of that kind. You can do it with men and women if we... I shouldn't show you that graph while talking about work on men and women. You know, if we'd get you to do some sort of mathematical or spatial thing, and sometimes we say before you start, women are often thought to be less good at these things. It affects women's performance to say that. With different ethnicities or different social classes, it makes a... this is an experiment using a kind of IQ test, and the blue columns are high socioeconomic status kids or students, and the orange ones low social status kids. And one group are told, this test is not a test of ability. And they do almost as well as each other. But when another group is told, this is a test of ability, the low status kids do less well. And if you're thinking about, you know, how often kids from deprived areas, schools in deprived areas, kids do less well, you have to think about these kinds of processes. We are extremely sensitive to these sort of social stereotypes. Is that all right, Jane?
I'm afraid that's us out of time, Richard, but we want to say thank you very, very much for what's been a fantastic presentation.